Case number 5, 071460, Kitsy Amrine versus Healthcare Services, and it's Mr. Baker. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is James Baker, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Kitsy Amrine. This case involves a Title VII retaliation claim. The district court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment. And in the time allotted to me this morning, I would like to speak to one aspect of Ms. Amrine's case, and that is the adequacy of her evidence of retaliation utilizing the direct proof method.
Could I ask you, though, as a preliminary matter, what is the protected act that she's being retaliated for? Because this looks to me like a case where your fundamental theory is that she threatened to go to the EEOC, but she didn't go to the EEOC, so it's not an EEOC filing that she could have been retaliated for. That happens long after she gets terminated. And so I'm just unclear exactly what you're focusing on.
Well, she didn't have time to go to EEOC.
Well, but I know, but your theory is retaliation. Usually you'll have a protected act, you know,
correct,
protected under the statute. Then the retaliation happens, and the person says, because I took this protected act, some adverse thing happened to me. The Supreme Court has said it doesn't have to be strictly tied to employment, but a bad thing happened, right? So what's your protected act, or what's her protected act?
Well, her protected act began in December of 2003 when she first filed an informal complaint under the processes available to Blue Cross Blue Shield.
So it's the filing of the informal complaint.
Well, that starts the clock in motion. That's not it completely. She started the filing. An abbreviated investigation occurred.
Right.
And that gets us to mid-January of 2004, where Ms. Amrine met with her supervisor and an HR rep, and they, in a summary fashion, told her that they didn't think there was any evidence of gender discrimination. They didn't share with her the work product of their investigation. They just announced that conclusion. At that point in time, she indicated that's fine, that she intended at that point to take her claim to EEOC.
Now, do you know of any cases where a statement like that is the fulcrum of the case, a statement like that is the protected act? I haven't done it yet, but I'm thinking of going to the EEOC.
Frankly, Judge Woods,
I looked around, and I haven't. I've seen people talk around it, but I haven't seen that precisely. But maybe you know of some.
Well, I'm scratching my head, and I'm somewhat unprepared to answer that question for the reason that that was never really an issue in the minds of the district court, and it was not an issue that was briefed by either side in this appeal. My recollection of the statute, and it may be mistaken, is that it protects complaints about gender discrimination, it protects cooperation in investigations, and it protects moving forward with actually
okay,
a formal
proceeding.
Okay,
so the December complaint, I mean, you don't have a timeliness issue anyway, I think. But so you would be pretty safe on the December complaint, probably. Your opponents on the merits of your case focus a lot on what they see as the lack of comparability between Ms. Amrine and the various other people, Mr. Redpath, Ms. Woods, you know, Hall, or Hall Parker, whatever her name is. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Okay, and I'd be happy to. I'd like to preface my comment to make the lack of comparability goes to the evidence under the indirect proof method in terms of whether a prima facie claim was made.
Forgive me for interrupting, but while you're doing it, perhaps you could zero in on whether or not there was any single employee who both violated the code of conduct twice and was insubordinate.
There is no employee we can identify who was accused of doing precisely all the things that Ms. Amrine did who was not disciplined. We concede we had to piecemeal issues. Having said that, let me begin by with Ms. Wood. She was a supervisor who actually made the termination decision. She was subject to the very same code of conduct as with Ms. Zamrine. And although the content and the context of the disclosure was different, she shared precisely the same types of information to the same people and others that Ms. Amrine did. There really was no difference between the type of information she disclosed. She talked about a Blue Cross policy of making guarantees and the reason why guarantees were made.
Healthcare Service or Blue Cross, whoever, says, look, it's one thing to state this at a high level of generality, which is what Ms. Woods apparently did. And it sounds like a nice thing. At that point, we have guarantees. We do all these great things. It's quite another thing to sit there in a very specific case and say, the reason I'm not answering this phone is because I'm off here covering that, and it makes you sound like you're kind of a sketchy organization that's not fully staffed. So is the general really the same as the specific?
Within the context of the code of conduct, it's precisely the same. The code of conduct says thou shalt not disclose certain company processes or procedures as well as other types of confidential information. And that's what she was accused of having done, mm-hmm. breached that particular requirement. And although the context is different, that's exactly the same thing that Ms. Wood did. I think there's distinctions, but I don't think the distinctions amount to a credible difference.
What if, though, again, looking for comparability at the right level, we have said things like, do you report to the same supervisor? Are you doing roughly the same job? And certainly that's not the case as between Ms. Amrine and Ms. Woods, since Ms. Woods is higher placed. Don't higher placed people have more discretion about what to disclose or not?
There's nothing in the code of conduct that suggests they do.
Okay.
The code of conduct applies to all Blue Cross Blue Shield employees. I did not address the two other individuals, and let me do that quickly because I think I'm cutting into my rebuttal time.
You are. You're in it. You are in it.
Okay, I'll attempt to be quick. Mr. Redpath, who was the male counterpart to Ms. Amrine, he didn't do precisely the same things, but he did a number of things that would constitute code of conduct violations. In addition to that, he had attendance-related issues, and there was nothing done to him. He did the same type of work Ms. Amrine did. He reported to the same supervisor. He was subject to the same working conditions. The last individual is a female employee whose name escapes my recollection.
Paul, right? The Paul. One who shouted at the meeting?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
Paul.
And at this February 14th incident and immediately before that, she engaged in conduct which a reasonable trier of fact could conclude was more egregious and received nothing more than an oral warning. We don't have one individual who's a precise comparable on all, but we do have a group of people who collectively we think are a fair comparison. I would like to reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Thies?
That's correct, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mr. Baker. My name is John Thies, and I represent Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Your name is familiar in the courtroom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The gentleman sitting right over there is named John Thies.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, we'll have to.
He's
get
my
caught
clerk,
up on...
so you should introduce yourself on the way out.
I hope that's a good thing. We've got to find out.
Is he related to Mary Jane? Well, there are two John Theses that
there
you
apparently
need to
are.
Meet. You need to meet his father.
It doesn't happen very often
right.
in the same room.
Father's
is this counting against my time?
And no. I'm going to give you the time. And his mother is just wonderful.
Well, if there were another Jim Baker
superb,
here, they'd be in a
superb judge in the Appellate Court of Illinois.
Well, I know the family very well. His father and I actually exchange mail for various things we do for the Bar Association.
Start the clock.
Don't get nervous now.
He's starting the clock again, yeah.
Okay.
I don't recall if Mr. Baker made reference to this, but the termination that is at issue in this case, Ms. Amrine, was March 1st of 2004. And to put her retaliation claim in context, I want to highlight a couple of points. First of all, Amrine received a 5-day suspension and probation in January of 2003, the year before her termination.
But before you get too much into this, I know you spend a lot of time in your brief talking about her record, if you will, at the company. But
yes,
that's that set of facts. But there's the opposite way of looking at this, which is that she gets, you know, the positive performance rating right up till the time she's terminated. The reasons she's given for the termination don't include, shall we say, recidivism in terms of code of conduct violations. She's told this one phone call, which certainly reads in a very innocuous way, and then her encounter with Ms. Markadant, if that's how she pronounces her name, for which we even have some disputed testimony, since people standing right nearby didn't hear the supposed shouting and so on. I don't see why we might not have a jury issue here as to what the real reason the company had for taking the action it did was.
Well, in the first
I'm not saying you have zero evidence, but yeah, that's not the standard, of course.
That's right. First of all, in the case of the altercation with Ms. Markadant, the only person that Mr. Baker can point to is Ellen Moore Hall, who was a fellow group specialist and who acknowledged in her deposition that she was obstructed from that conversation.
But what he's pointing out, though, I think, is just if two people are standing 5 feet away from you and they're shouting at each other, you might not hear every word they were saying, but you would know they were shouting. And she, as I understand it, indicated that she was standing close enough that she would have heard raised voices or angry voices had they been going on. So it's the absence of hearing that's actually the important thing.
Well, all I can say, Your Honor, is that the record reflects that Ms. Hall acknowledged that she was obstructed. And there is the other evidence where people were not obstructed. It's very difficult to argue that there wasn't a problem with this conversation when you have Jan Rowe, who had a compliance complaint where she specifically referred to it, saying that Ms. Amrine had caused an uproar and had really set out to be very difficult within the unit. You also had another group specialist who went with a still third group specialist to their supervisor, Ms. Benner, where they complained about the incident. And so
Well, you have evidence on that side, but I guess, you know, what evidence? In fact, Ms. Amrine's testimony herself is competent testimony as to the nature of the conversation. A jury might, she was a participant in it. She's not hearsay or it's not anything that would be inadmissible. Why don't we have fact issues where you would introduce all of those points that you just made and she would say, no, it was a calm and collected disagreement about a matter of policy, but it was being conducted in a professional way.
Respectfully, Judge, it's you have to look at the whole record to determine whether you have an issue of fact.
And we can't weigh inferences either.
Well, what you have here is you have really the only person that she points to other than her own testimony.
There's nothing wrong with her testimony, though. That's a widespread misconception. Her testimony is competent.
The issue also, I think, had to do with the tone of the conversation. It was not just the volume of the conversation. And you had multiple people that were very emphatic that the tone of the conversation was inappropriate. Mr. Redpath also testified to that during his deposition, in addition to the supervisor, to the assistant manager, to two other group specialists.
So have you never been in a trial where five witnesses testified to one thing and one witness testified to the opposite and the jury decided to believe the one?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor, in circumstances quite like this. But
I mean, there are never trials anymore, so I guess that probably.
It's why I direct the panel back to the issue of what the whole record is. And you made mention of the issue of the entire disciplinary record of Ms. Amrine. The record is quite clear that at the time of the termination, the earlier suspension and probation was taken into consideration.
But she was not told that. She was told the Petticone phone conversation where she makes this kind of idle comment,
yes,
and the confrontation with Mark Wedant. She's told those two things.
I was responding to Your Honor's point about whether or not any of these items were brought up later, for example, in the evaluation. The evaluation in 2004 specifically made mention to the earlier probation and suspension. So there is a history of that.
You know, can we talk about the evidence about Woods, setting aside whether or not she was similarly situated, for the purpose of making out a prima facie case. Woods had previously disclosed the same information to the same person that United. So Woods, who was a decision maker in the termination, knew beyond doubt that it was not confidential information, I take it.
No.
Why would that not be evidence of pretext?
And the auditors didn't think it was either.
First of all, the question of the comparability of Ms. Woods. She's not a comparable
with
the Seventh
Circuit
decision.
Set that aside, yeah.
So the issue of whether or not it's confidential is I think, the point. And there really, the district court found that there really was quite a different context. In fact, Mr. Baker acknowledged earlier when he was in oral argument that the context was quite different. You had a meeting of high-level people who were talking about the relationship between the two entities and performance guarantees, which is a great contrast to what you had here, where there was no, and by the way, the performance guarantees that were discussed in that high-level meeting were United Airlines performance guarantees. There was no indication when Ms. Amrine had the conversation with Ms. Pericone that she was leaving to go work on United Airlines performance guarantees. It could have been any other client that she was called away to work on. So there was a distinction in that sense as well.
Did the district court make an error of law in finding that the other issues brewing overrode the possibility that the employer was also motivated by retaliation? In other words, if the employer had a mixed motive, how would your argument change?
I don't agree that there was an error. I don't think that the district court hung her hat on that point to reach her conclusion. I think what she was doing was speaking to the significance of the email from Ms. Woods to her supervisor she said that Ms. Amrine had been a huge challenge. And so the court said, Ms. Amrine is asking the court to speculate wildly that this was because of comments that had been made about gender discrimination. And instead of that, we have this environment where you have a two-time refusal to sign a warning for excessive personal telephone use. You have the fact that she was complaining that she did not get a merit increase when she had been told.
I have to say, the personal telephone use should you prevail, would go down in the annals of, even though companies are heartless and awful because people's fathers die, nieces are trying to commit suicide, other people are happening. You're coming down because she talks on the phone for 36 minutes in a month, which sounds...
Well,
it's not that you don't have the right to have whatever unattractive employment policies you want to have, but it's pretty bad.
Well, Your Honor, the only point I'd like to make there is that it was across the board. There was a problem identified with the quality controllers, that there was a problem
across
the board.
Everyone else's father died too, or what?
Well, the issue of personal telephone use was something that had been going on over time. I don't think the record suggests that it happened only after Ms. Amrine's father died.
Well, that's the month that she was reprimanded for it. It was in October, if I remember.
And others received reprimands as well. So you had a history, and it was only brought up for that reason. I see that my time has expired unless the court...
You have a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're trying to keep you all here.
Okay. Well, it is not as though she was the only one who was cited for that behavior, and it did not lead to her termination. This was simply a written warning that she received. I would submit that the greater question is that on two separate occasions, she had the opportunity simply to acknowledge the warning by signing it, something that Mr. Redpath did voluntarily. Ms. Amrine would not do. And I think what Judge Scott was doing is just saying that you had this environment that was so contentious from Ms. Amrine, and that to her was much more credible than the speculative idea.
Watch your language. She's not going to weigh credibility.
What I mean to say is that it requires speculation to conclude that it was because of these isolated complaints, and she didn't feel it required speculation to reach the other conclusion. Another point that I wanted to make is that because the panel discussed early on the issue of when this protected act took place, and the Amrine has been all over the board on this question. In her pleadings initially, she was asserting that the first complaint of gender bias was in December of 2002. And then, as the briefs have shown, and Mr. Baker argued it here today, we're focusing on December of 2003. So at a minimum, I would argue that they have conceded that they have taken the position throughout the case that the complaints of gender bias happened 17 months prior to this termination. So this is not a case where you have temporal proximity between the allegation and the termination. Now, I don't concede that qualified under applicable law, but nonetheless, I think they should be held to that standard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chase.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Judge Roedner asked Mr. Thies, as I recall it, whether Judge Scott committed legal error when she referred to other issues as a possible reason for some concerns being raised about Ms. Amrine's conduct. And I would submit that was precisely the basis for her rejecting Ms. Amrine's circumstantial evidence. On page 55 of our short appendix appears the text, and I think the key part of her rejection of Amrine's circumstantial evidence of retaliation on the direct method. And she said two things. In fact, I'll quote it. Judge Scott says, 6 weeks represents a fairly substantial passage of time. Amrine herself admits that there were issues other than her EEOC claim brewing during this time period. So that seems to be the key for her rejecting Ms. Amrine's circumstantial evidence. I would suggest there are several problems with that analysis. The first problem is that one of the decision makers, Karen Wood, knew nothing about those issues. During her deposition and during Ms. Marquardt's deposition, they were both asked what information was communicated about Ms. Amrine to her in January and February, and none of that information was communicated. Second, Ms. Woods wrote an email on February 4th to her boss wanting to talk about options with Ms. Amrine because she was becoming a huge challenge. Now, this is within 2 weeks of when she initially announced she was going to go to EEOC, and within several days of when she had a follow-up conversation with her supervisor and indicated she intended to go to EEOC. At that point in time, Ms. Wood knew nothing about these other issues which were brewing. Secondly, in this case, my understanding of the law of this circuit is in a mixed motive situation, and that apparently is what we have here. It's Ms. Amrine's burden not to identify that her EEO intentions were the exclusive or the sole reason for termination, but rather that it was a cause, one among others. And I think the evidence in this case supports that it was, and Judge Scott essentially said there could be other things, meaning there could be multiple reasons. In short, I would just close by saying I think this is a case where the defendants, both in their presentation today and in their briefs, have identified why this is an appropriate case for trial. There are a number of competing inferences which could be presented to a jury concerning why it was she was terminated, and in my view, it's the function of a jury to resolve those inferences.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone. And the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you very much.